arguments for God's existence. We'll probably spend a few more weeks on this. We talked about the ontological argument and the first type of cosmological arguments, Thomas Aquinas's cosmological argument from existential causality. Now, keep in mind that Aquinas... Let me try to explain the difference between Aquinas and Bonaventure, and they were contemporaries. Bonaventure used the Kalam cosmological argument, which is now making a comeback. If we had, let's say we had a series of cause and effects on this table going forward, so that the first cause was here, and then it caused an effect, which caused another effect, and another effect all along that table, the Kalam cosmological argument would argue from these effects back to that first cause, okay? But Aquinas's argument from existential causality would try to see, well, why are all these effects, causes and effects, suspended in the air? And the cause for them being suspended in the air of all these effects would be the table, okay? So that's kind of the way Aquinas was arguing. He was arguing for the sustaining cause. Yeah. He argued that there are certain things that exist that are dependent on other things for their existence.
Right.
I'm dependent on air, water for my continued existence. And that if you added up all these dependent beings, you would get one big dependent whole. Okay? And that dependent whole would then be dependent upon something else for its continuing existence. And Aquinas argued eventually you have to arrive at a being that is totally independent, that doesn't depend on anything else for its continued existence, and that would be the ground of all other existence. So when Aquinas argues for God as the cause of the universe, he's looking at God as the sustaining cause of the universe, not the beginning cause, okay? With Bonaventure, he uses the Kalam cosmological argument, which was actually very popular among Islamic philosophers arguing for God's existence. And this argues that God has to be the cause of the beginning of the universe, okay? Probably the two leading proponents, contemporary proponents of the Kalam cosmological argument are two friends of mine, William Lane Craig and J.P. Moreland out of Talbot School of Theology. And with the cosmological argument, it argues along these lines: everything that has a beginning needs a cause. Then it argues the universe had a beginning, therefore the universe needs a cause. First, everything that has a beginning needs a cause. Other ways of saying that would be as follows. Non-being cannot cause being. From nothing, nothing comes. I mean, you could even, I sometimes expand on that. I tell people that I could tell them a whole lot about nothing, but from nothing, nothing comes. Nothing is nothing, therefore nothing can do nothing. You have to be something in order to be able to do something. So nothing is nothing, therefore nothing can do nothing, therefore nothing could cause nothing. So if something began to exist, it couldn't cause its own beginning of existence, because then it would have to pre-exist its own existence in order to bring its own existence about, and that's absurd. So if something had a total beginning in its existence, it had to be caused to exist by something else. Whatever the case, if we can show that the universe had a beginning, then we could argue that it, therefore it needs a cause. Two lines of argumentation, well, there's actually three, but one is very, very complex. The two scientific ways of arguing for the beginning of the universe, first is the second law of thermodynamics, which is energy deterioration Although the first law of thermodynamics says that the amount of energy remains the same in the universe, no energy is presently being created or destroyed. At the same time, though the amount of energy in the universe remains constant, it changes forms. And as it changes forms, it becomes less and less usable to us. In other words, we can burn a log and get heat from it, but once we've completely burnt that log so that it's totally ashes, we can't get anything else out of it. We've used up the energy there. And so the second law of thermodynamics argues that in a closed system, the amount, the energy reaches a stage eventually, will reach a stage of equilibrium where no work can be done. So basically the amount of usable energy is running out. Now, that's what life is all about from the scientific viewpoint, is that we're not closed systems. We take in energy from the sun, we take in energy from the food and that we eat and the water that we drink. But when you look at the universe and you study it scientifically, you have to look at it from the standpoint of as a closed system, as no energy coming in from the outside. And that's consistent with atheism, which believes there is nothing outside the universe. But it's also consistent with Christianity, which said that God completed his creation work, so that he is no longer creating new energy. So either the atheist or the Christian, neither one of them is going to argue with the view, viewing the universe in this sense as a closed system. And so basically what it amounts to is that the universe is running, it's winding down, it's running out of usable energy. But that means if you were able to go backwards in time, eventually you reach a point where all the energy in the universe was usable. And that would mark the beginning of the universe. If the universe is winding down, that means if you go backwards and if it's winding down, it means that at one point it had to be wound up. If it's going to have an end, that means it had to have a beginning. Okay? The second law of thermodynamics argues, I think that's really, to be honest with you, from a scientific standpoint, that's all we need, because the first and second laws of thermodynamics are considered the most firmly established laws of science. Okay, so I don't think we need anything beyond that. At the same time, presently, Big Bang cosmology supports the beginning of the universe as well. Now, I'm not quite so sure that Big Bang, that there really was a Big Bang. There are certain things that seem to go against that, okay? But whatever the case, most scientists today believe that the universe, and I think everybody would agree that the universe does appear to be expanding as we move forward in time, expanding in all directions, much like you would see the effect of an explosion. So that if you were to go backwards in time, the universe would become more and more dense until scientists in their journals say that eventually you would reach the universe would be shrunk down to a point of infinite density or a point of dimensionless space. Okay? Now keep in mind, we're talking about the physical universe. We're talking about physical things. So when you're talking about a physical thing, if it takes up a physical thing that is shrunk down to a point of infinite density, okay, what does that mean? Well, for something to be infinitely dense, it means to be small or compact without limit. So no matter how small you're thinking, it's smaller than that. And basically what it means is it's a point that is so small without limit that it's not even there anymore. And, well, you know, why do scientists say a point of infinite density? Well, they don't want to say in the beginning the universe wasn't there, and then boom, it was. It sounds too much like Genesis 1:1, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth. The other phrase that they use in their journals is that the universe shrunk down to a point of infinite density. Oh, and it takes up a point in dimensionless space. Okay? Well, again, if you're talking about something physical, if it doesn't take up any dimensions in space, it takes up no space. In other words, it's nowhere. It's nothing. It's nowhere. And so, again, it's just real heavy professional jargon so that they can avoid using the word nothing, which sounds too, you know, too much like Genesis 1:1. I mean, they don't want to come right out and say, well, in the beginning there was nothing, and then boom, there was a universe. Robert Jastrow, who's not a Christian, he's an agnostic, he questions whether God exists or not, but he wrote a book called God and the Astronomers, where he closed that book with a paragraph about how scientists, due to the Big Bang model, scientists have scaled the highest mountains of knowledge. And when they reached up to the highest peak and pulled themselves up, they found a band of theologians waiting there for them for centuries. And so what he's basically saying is the Big Bang model takes us right back to Genesis 1:1. Jeffrey Burbidge, at a California State University in Berkeley. You know, California State University has campuses all throughout California, but he's an astrophysicist. He's either an astrophysicist or a cosmologist, but he's an atheist, and he basically complained that he can't stand that all his colleagues are running off to join the Church of Christ of the Big Bang. And what he's basically saying is that a lot of his colleagues are looking at the evidence and becoming Christians. He disagrees with them, but he's admitting that is the trend among many scientists in studying in this field. So, but whatever the case, the list goes on of different scientists who are acknowledging that if the Big Bang model is true, it just further reinforces the idea of a beginning of the universe, which then takes us right back to the first premise of the Kalam cosmological argument: everything that has a beginning needs a cause. Premise number two: the universe had a beginning, therefore the universe needs a cause. Now, there is a philosophical argument for the beginning of the universe based upon infinite set theory in mathematics. And I'm going to just try to put it in layman's terms. Rather than give than talk about infinite set theory,
Well, maybe
I'll talk about it a little. But, okay, let's say set A. In fact, I've got this somewhere in the notes. Now, if I could find it, that's a whole other thing. Look at AP 17, or page 17. I give an example of three sets. See, if the universe is eternal, okay, that would mean that an actual... See, mathematics, by definition, deals with the possible realm. Okay? In other words, when we say 4 plus 2 equals 6, that doesn't tell us that we have 6 apples unless we find 4 apples and then 2 more apples. Okay? So, if an actual infinite set... If the universe is eternal, it would mean an actual infinite set of finite events have occurred to reach the present moment now. So you could never go back to a first event, because no matter how many moments you go back, you know, there's an infinite number. So no matter how many moments you go back in time, you'd still have more and more to go, okay? But whatever the case, if the universe is eternal, then you have an infinite number of moments that have actually occurred in time. But when you look at infinite sets, you find out that absurdities arise, which tell us, oh boy, J.P. Moreland and Craig argue in their books that an actual infinite set of things cannot exist. And I called J.P. Moreland up and I explained why I thought that premise was wrong. He agreed with me and said that he had come to the same conclusion. He hasn't changed it in print. But basically, I figured out that an actual infinite set of finite things could only exist in a mind. Outside of a mind, then it starts creating contradictions and absurdities. But it could exist in a mind. However, by definition, it would have to be an infinite mind. In order to know an infinite number of things, that's number one. Number two, it couldn't have learned the infinite number of things one thing at a time, because then you'd never reach an infinite. You could always add one more to it. It has, the only way it could know the infinite number of things is in one eternal glance, one eternal thought. So basically, I believe an actual infinite set of thoughts or ideas exist in the mind of God. If that's not the case, heaven's going to get incredibly boring, because eventually we'll know everything that God knows. Because given eternity, we'll keep learning and learning, eventually we'd catch up. And that's not going to be the case. So no matter how many things we learn, we'll never know all that God knows. We'll be learning out more and more about Him. But whatever the case, if there's an actual infinite set of moments, if the universe is eternal, then that's outside the mind, and that's where it generates contradictions. But take a look at it. See, you can't slice an infinite, is what it comes down to. Because a slice of an infinite is just as infinite as the infinite is. Look at three infinite sets. Set A, starting at 1, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, on and on infinitely. Okay, that's an infinite set. Set B, 1, 3, 5, 7, 9, just the odd numbers, it has half the members of set A. Yet, they're both infinite, so they both have the identical amount of numbers. But how can it have the same numbers, yet only half the numbers at the same time and in the same way? It violates the law of non-contradiction. Set C, 10, 20, 30, 40, 50, just right there, multiples of 10, it has one-tenth of the members of set A and one-fifth of the members of set B, yet all three sets are equal because they're all infinite. So they're equal and not equal at the same time in the same way. It violates the law of non-contradiction, and so they can't exist outside of a mind. Another way of looking at it, you know, Zeno used to do that with his paradoxes, the Greek philosopher. He started to get from point A to get from here to that wall. First, I have to get halfway, reach the midpoint. But before I can reach the midpoint, I've got to get to the midpoint between here and the midpoint. But before I can reach that midpoint, I've got to get halfway. Before I can do that, I get it. And his conclusion was, therefore, movement is impossible, and everything, all the physical world is an illusion, and everything is one being. Well, I think he was wrong with his conclusion, because he was assuming an actual number of infinites between point A and point B. But there's only, you could potentially divide it infinitely, but that's a potential infinite. It's not an actual infinite. There's really only if you took actual things like tops of bottle caps and put them down, you'd get a finite number. You wouldn't get an infinite number. Okay? And so because something is infinitely, you know, you could divide it infinitely, doesn't necessarily mean that there really is an infinite number of points between the two. And that, I think, was where Zeno was missing the boat. But what he did show was it's impossible to traverse an actual infinite. Okay? Now, the fact that movement is possible lets us know that there's not an actual infinite between this point and that wall. But the fact that it's impossible to traverse an actual infinite, in other words, if you're trying to cross if you're trying to cross, or if you're trying to walk up an infinite number of steps, no matter how many steps you go up, there's still an infinite number more. Yeah, because you can't add one to an infinite, and you can always go one more step. So, but an easier way for me to see this would be this. If there's an infinite number of, if the universe is eternal, there is an infinite number of moments before the moment we call now.
We would never get to now.
So we would never reach now, okay? Because you can't traverse an actual infinite set. We would never reach the moment now. If there was an infinite number of moments before any point in time, you would never reach that point in time. And so if time is real, and I think we have to even think in terms of time. Anybody who tries to deny time involves themselves in all kinds of contradictions, including Stephen Hawking. I mean, in his work, Hawking openly admits that his model of the universe, which tries to explain away the beginning of the universe, it only works if we assume that real time is imaginary. But he openly admits he has no idea what that would look like. But then he asked us to just kind of join him on his voyage and on his journey there. But whatever the case, if there's an infinite number of moments, an unlimited number of moments before the present moment now, we would never reach the present moment now. Since we've reached the present moment now, there's only a finite, a limited number of moments before the present moment now, which means there had to be a first event. So God basically doesn't exist in time. He exists in eternity, the eternal now. And when he created the first changing beings, that's when time began. In other words, time is a creation of God. Okay? There are some evangelical theologians that are trying, and philosophers that are trying to argue that God exists in everlasting time, that he doesn't exist in eternity. And I tell them when I see them at meetings, Evangelical Theological Society, you're doing a lot of damage to the Christian worldview, because your view of God falls prey to Zeno's paradoxes. Zeno's paradoxes have never been answered because they can't be answered. He misapplied them, but the fact of the matter is you cannot traverse an actual infinite set. And if the universe is eternal, then we would have, in order to reach the present moment now, we would have had to traverse an actual infinite set, which is impossible. So whatever the case, the universe, everything that has a beginning needs a cause. The universe had a beginning, therefore the universe needs a cause. Now, people could say, okay, so the universe needs a cause, but maybe that cause had a beginning. Well, fine. Then that means that the cause of the universe needs a cause. And then they might say, well, maybe that one has a cause. And then eventually they might say, well, maybe it just goes back forever and ever, cause and effect.
Unending.
Yeah. Well, what do you have? Again, you would have an infinite set of causes and effects running. So basically, you would have just what we showed cannot exist outside of a mind, and existing outside of a mind. So in other words, there had to be a first cause, and the only way that makes sense is if that first cause is not part of this chopped up thing called time, past, present, and future. So if there's an eternal first cause, an uncaused cause of the universe as the ultimate cause of the universe, then that explains why the universe is here. Now, I would go, when I argue along these lines, I would then argue that the cause of the universe must be personal by using the teleological argument, which is the argument from the design in the universe, tells us that there must be a designer of the universe, an intelligent designer. So whatever the cause of the universe is, the cause of the universe has intelligence. And then I would use the moral argument, saying that the eternal, unchanging moral laws that exist in the universe must have an eternal unchanging moral lawgiver. Now, we're going to spend more time on those when we're done with the cosmological argument, but basically what I'm saying is that's how I go from the Kalam cosmological argument, how I put the finishing touches on it to show that the uncaused causes is also an intelligent and a moral being, therefore the uncaused cause of the universe is a personal being, okay? So it's not the force be with you, it's the Lord be with you. It's a personal God, not an it, not something, some force like electricity. Now, we will spend more time on that, talking about different types of teleological arguments, arguments from design, different types of moral arguments. But that's just how I put the finishing touches on it. Now, let me say this. William Lane Craig puts the finishing touches on it in a very different way, one paragraph, and I don't use that argumentation. I think it's solid, very solid. Problem is, you either get it or you don't, and most of the people that attend debates that I engage in probably would not be able to follow it. So they would basically think that I'm just getting into some semantical smokescreen or something. But basically, you look at Spinoza's thought really comes into play here. Basically, what Craig argues, the only way that you can have a temporal effect, a time-bound effect, caused by an eternal cause, i.e. God, okay, it would involve a free choice, and only personal beings make free choices. In other words, see, Benedict Spinoza, Jewish philosopher, his concept of God was a lot like the pantheist God. His God was an impersonal force, and so because his God was impersonal, it couldn't make choices. And so everything his God did, it necessarily did. It had to do. They couldn't choose to do this or choose to do that. So in Spinoza's way of thinking, the world wasn't created, it always was. Because it just necessarily flowed from his impersonal God. When you understand where he's coming from there, it's a given that if all that existed was the eternal God, and then boom, the universe came into existence caused by the eternal God, the question comes up, well, why? Why the creation? If God had to create, since he's an eternal being, he would have had to eternally create. But he didn't. He created, all of a sudden, boom, the universe exists, when technically this is bad philosophical language, but before the universe, there was no time. Of course, before is a time-bound term. So apart from the universe, there's just eternity. And there's no way to explain why an eternal God would create a time-bound universe unless he chose to do it. Okay, there's a free choice. Because if it was necessary, like I believe the law of non-contradiction, the laws of logic, the laws of mathematics, necessarily flow from God. Because God is rational, all rational principles necessarily flow from him. So God didn't have a choice to make the law of non-contradiction or not. It just necessarily flowed from him. Yeah, from his nature. Yeah, exactly. Yet, God was free to either create or not create, and he chose to create. But creation is not necessarily have to come into existence. And the way William Lane Craig puts it is that if a guy is It's like an eternal guy, a guy through all eternity is sitting on a bench, and then all of a sudden he stands up. Okay? Now, if the eternal guy was always standing, you could say, well, maybe he just necessarily stands. But since he was sitting for all eternity, and then all of a sudden, boom, he stands up, you wonder why. And Craig would argue, well, apparently, he freely chose to stand. But once you bring in free choice, you're showing that this is a personal being. Richard Swinburne, another Christian philosopher, he makes a big distinction between physical causes and personal causes. And that he argues that certain effects can be explained by physical causes, but there's some effects that can only be explained by personal causes. For instance, if we had a Scrabble game up here and Carlito walked in the room and he looked on the floor and all the letters were scattered and didn't make any sense, then he would probably conclude, well, it probably fell off the table. But if he walked in the room and the Scrabble letters spelled out the Oakland Raiders rock, okay, then he would say, okay, Raider fan, probably Fernandez, spelled out the words on the floor, okay? So Swinburne would use that in the intelligent design argument that you can only explain information and evidence of design by an intelligent designer. But it would also, but it's that kind of thing that applies here with William Lane Craig, that sometimes a physical cause or at least a non-personal cause just doesn't do it. And you have to have a personal cause because a choice was involved. Some thinking was involved, a volitional choice was involved, and but whatever the case, I would finish, I think it's easier to understand, I finish the Kalam cosmological argument with the design argument and the moral argument to show that God is the uncaused cause is a personal being. Okay, now, Leibniz, he's got the third type of cosmological argument, and it's the cosmological argument based on the principle of sufficient reason. He's looking for the reason why everything exists. You know, why does anything exist? You know, he asks that kind of question. And he says, well, you know, everything that exists needs an explanation as to why it exists. And eventually, we have to arrive at a self-explained being. A being which explains in itself why it exists. Okay, my existence can be explained by a lot of different factors, food, oxygen, shelter, my parents getting together, having a baby boy, naming him Phil. There's a lot of reasons why you could explain my existence. Eventually, you got to arrive at I am who I am. Well, the way God identified himself to Moses from the burning bush, the self-existent one, the self-explained one, the one who doesn't say I am because Joseph Fernandez and Angelina Minichino got together and had a baby boy and named him Phil. And there's enough air for him to breathe. And, you know, the reasons go on why we exist. But eventually, you got to arrive at one. I am who I am. I am. I am my own explanation for why I exist. Okay, now let me say something. Norman Geisler doesn't like this. Okay, Norman Geisler is a Thomist, so he sticks with existential causality. I think all three of these arguments are good arguments. Geisler, on one page, in a book he co-authored with Winfried Cordouan, another one of my friends. Cordouan's a funny guy. In that book, he says that, look, an explanation, there's no difference between an explanation and a cause. They're synonymous. Okay? That's what he says. And so he says that a self-explained being is just as much an oxymoron as a self-caused being. Now, a self-caused being would be a being that caused its own existence to come into existence. Its own being. That's impossible. You can't pre-exist your own existence in order to bring your own existence about. But I would argue against Geisler that Leibniz, when he said that God was self-explained, he meant the same thing that Aquinas meant when Aquinas called God self-existent. He didn't mean God as self-explained means that God is self-caused. He means that God contains in himself the own explanation for his existence, and that explanation is he is an uncaused being, not a self-caused being. He is pure existence. It is his nature to exist. He just naturally exists. All other existence is derived from him. Leibniz's self-explained being is not synonymous with a self-caused being. And I will also argue that just a couple pages later, Geisler and Cordovan then argue, first they argue explanation or reason are synonymous with cause. 2 pages later, they argue that an explanation or reason is not the same thing as a cause. And they say that it's not enough to give an explanation in your mind for why the world exists. You need an actual cause, a cause that's actually out there. So now all of a sudden, Geisler differentiates between. So when it serves Geisler's purposes, but by the way, Geisler's one of the best Christian apologists that is out there. It's just that decent thinkers are going to disagree on technicalities. And I think he's too hard on Leibniz. I think he's too hard on Bonaventure. I think he's too hard on Craig and Moreland, who were two of his pupils at one time. But whatever the case, I think Geisler and Cordovan are right that that explanation or a reason is not synonymous with a cause, but then I think they're wrong when they say that an explanation isn't enough. Because the only alternative to, well, there's really no explanation as to why the universe is, which is the only alternative to rejecting the self-explained being. But the statement that there's no explanation as to why the world is leads to the conclusion that nothing makes sense. But even the atheistic existentialists who claim that nothing makes sense, everybody lives like life makes sense. So though a person has an out, it's such an illogical out that no one can live consistently with it. So I think, you know, if they want to take that option, let them. You know, it just shows how weak their worldview is. But whatever the case, I think Leibniz had a really good argument here, once it's rightly understood, that everything that exists needs a reason why it exists, an explanation for why it exists. And eventually, in most beings, you find that their existence is explained by other beings. So eventually, you have to arrive at a being that contains within itself the explanation for its own existence, a self-explained being. So those are pretty much the cosmological arguments. The teleological and moral arguments are a little bit easier to understand. Does anybody have any questions or comments about the cosmological argument?
Just to make sure, you're just saying that Geisler's argument was that God didn't have to explain why he was caused, or he was just always there?
What Geisler's saying is that an explanation, he's implying that an explanation and a cause are synonymous, so that to say God is self-explained is to say he's self-caused, which is obviously impossible. But then 2 pages later, he admits that there's a difference, a distinction between an explanation and a cause. Because explanation is, it occurs in the mind, and a cause occurs outside the mind. Yeah. And you just think, in other words, to explain my existence, you got to go elsewhere. To explain God's existence, you don't got to go anywhere but to Him. To explain God's existence, you just got to look at, well, who is He? Oh, okay. Well, He explains His own existence because He exists by definition. I mean, He exists because He is existence. He is the ground of all existence. And so you don't have to go else. In other words, when you're looking for explanations, it either stops somewhere or it doesn't. If it doesn't, we really don't have an explanation as to why anything exists.
Right.
Life is totally absurd. If it does stop somewhere, where it stops,
God.
You need to drop to your knees. You're in the throne room of God. Yeah. So,
what part, if any, is it relevant to say that at that point where you're saying it stops with God, mystery? I mean, we don't know exactly where He,
Well,
does it have any?
I think that
mystery, meaning not knowing, we don't know.
Well, I think that's something that the Bible is clear about. A lot of atheists have argued, well, if the universe came from God, where did God come from? But I think the God of the Bible makes it real clear that's a question that doesn't even apply to God. God always is. I am who I am. So He is the eternal one, the infinite one, who has grounded the existence of all the finite things that exist. And so, in other words, I think God is in this sense, He's the big answer to all the questions, not the big question mark. Now, there are other aspects where He is big time the big question mark. Like, that God is three persons is
right.
Not a big question mark. But how God is three persons...
Right.
You got me. You know, I'm one being and one person. I don't understand how God could be one being and three persons, but He makes that very clear in the Scriptures that He is. And God has revealed so much about Himself to us that we still can't fully understand, so those are question marks. And then there's an infinite number of things He hasn't revealed to us about Himself, and that's... So there's more mystery to God than there is known. At the same time, we would not say that God is the unknowable one or the totally other.
Right.
Like so many Hindus and liberal theologians have said, no, God can be known, but He cannot be known exhaustively. He can only be known in a limited manner. Now, Aquinas went on to say that not only can we not know everything there is to know about God, but Aquinas also argues that every individual thing that we know about God, we only know that in an imperfect, limited way. So even Aquinas says that even each fact that we know about God, we don't fully understand all the implications of that fact.
Mm-hmm.
But we do know that fact.
Right.
So we're not skeptics, we're not agnostics. Yeah, man can know God because God has revealed Himself to us, but we're limited in our understanding, and God hasn't revealed everything to us, so when everything comes down to it, there's more mysterious elements to God than there is those which
can
be known. But there's enough,
mm-hmm.
God has revealed enough for us to not only know of His existence, but to know Him personally, and to enter into a saving personal love relationship with Him. And so those who, the Hindus, the New Agers that meditate and God is this blank check, this unknowable thing, this entity that is beyond being and beyond knowledge, And then that's crept into the church. Karl Barth, he basically argued that the Bible is a fallible book. It has errors in it, but it contains the Word of God and becomes the Word of God. When we, at a moment of crisis, we have an existential encounter with Jesus through the Word, But you can't put that encounter into words. Well, what he's doing is he's taking existentialism, which is much more, although you had Soren Kierkegaard, the father of modern existentialism, professed to be a Christian, existentialism where life is without meaning and is beyond reason, it doesn't really mix with Christianity. And so Karl Barth was turning Christianity, his neo-orthodoxy, really, if he consistently followed it out, would be closer to a New Age type of thinking, or a pantheistic type thinking, where the Bible almost becomes a